Hi, family. I'm an addict. My name is Martin. The NA member chosen to speak at a meeting needs to be someone who is working and living the NA program of recovery. Which are the 12 steps and 12 traditions? In areas where there is not an abundance of NA members with substantial clean time or experience with the 12 steps and 12 traditions, there is the possibility that a group inexperienced in Narcotics Anonymous may misunderstand NA traditions and invite speakers from outside the NA fellowship. There are several ways to avoid this situation. Our basic text, for instance, reminds us that NA members from other areas are willing to drive long distances to support new groups. The speaker helps fulfill the group's primary purpose, carrying the message of recovery to the addict who still suffers. When speaking at an NA meeting, we should be careful to deliver a clear message of recovery by identifying ourselves as addicts recovering from the disease of addiction. It is not necessary to dwell excessively on our active addiction or war stories, because we all know what it is like to use. We came to Narcotics Anonymous to stop using, and we are here to share our experience, strength, and hope of recovery. I would like to ask everyone to please take a moment for all the addicts that are still suffering and those who have died in these rooms clean recently. All right, here we go. First, I need to say it's an honor and a privilege to be asked to be of service in Narcotics Anonymous. I've spent the better part of the last 15 years of my life doing that in as many ways as I possibly could, because I am eternally grateful for the gift of life that I've been given in these rooms. And I say a new life because I came here on death's doorstep. It truly was the last thing left for me. I am currently walking through the pain, and you guys are bringing it out by asking me to do this shit, so hang on. Last week I buried a very good friend, a gentleman that I sponsored for 7 years, and and in February I put my best friend in the world, my sponsor, in the ground. He was a few days short of 30 years clean. And he carried me through some of the worst pain that I've ever experienced in recovery next to losing to him. And I got to tell you that I love my God. I'm not ashamed to say I have a God and I love my God, but I don't always like his decisions. And I miss my friends. A year and a half ago, I had to bury another sponsee clean. 7 years I worked with him, and he was the gentlest soul that ever walked this earth. Boy, didn't even need to write a four-step. Shit. How I walk through the pain, I walk through it with faith. I walk through it with love and support. I network. I have people in this fellowship that I can trust, that I can call, that I can cry to, that will hold me, that will love me. And I walk through it with the steps. I walk through it with a sponsor. I walk through it with God. So right now, this is real hard for me because the one key link between me and God is gone. And I'm having a real hard time finding anybody to fill his shoes. And I don't know why, but I can't get him out of my head. I hear him everywhere I go and everything I do. And he had a unique delivery system, see, because the way he talked to me, when I come to him, he would look at me and he'd say, "Nigga, please." For those of you who had the benefit of ever meeting him, his name was Fast Eddie. And I ain't never met no one other like him. And my heart hurts. And I pray. And I haven't asked for a whole lot of help because, you see, I'm not going to use over any of this pain. I've gone through pain for the better part of the last 15 years since the day I got here. This has not been easy. This has been the hardest thing I've ever had to do. See, because y'all asked me to do shit like look at myself, take my own inventory. You didn't tell me you was going to take my inventory for me. You made me do it. You made me write it down on paper. You made me share it with another human being. And I got to say that, like, when I express this stuff to you, I'm real. I didn't get this we suggest shit when I got here. I got, you're going to do this or die. Plain and simple. They knew if I used again, I was dead. So they told me, you must do this or you will die. And so they made me grow up. Here is where I grew up. Here is my family. Here is everything that I've ever learned. I came here at 33 and a half years old. I had never had a bank account in my life. I had never worked successfully at a job, honestly. I didn't know what it was like to take care of myself, to sleep properly, to eat properly, to bathe properly. I didn't learn any of that stuff out there when I was living as a kid. See, because I started using when I was 7 years old. Okay? I grew up in the ghetto. I went to school. It was 98% black. We grew up in gangs to survive. Okay? It wasn't about turf wars. It was about survival. And so, needless to say, I came here and I learned a new way of life. I treasure that new way of life, so I get really bitter and resentful when people don't. And what happens is, see, when you come up to me and you hug me and you tell me you love me, I trust you unconditionally until you give me a reason not to. And because when people did that for me when I first got here, man, these people had, like, walked this walk and they had some integrity and some dignity. And they knew what it was about. And they didn't care whether or not they hurt my feelings. You know, when they came up to me and told me about women, they said, stay the fuck away from them. Period. They said, you don't know shit about having a relationship with anybody, including yourself. How the fuck are you going to give something to somebody else? You know? And so I did some real work with my first sponsor. His wife's here in this room. I buried him, too. Direct result of this disease. He had 8 years and went back out. So I know the disease doesn't play games. It's still alive and well. And it wants me. I don't believe it wants me dead. I believe it wants me to suffer. And so I work steps. Steps are my defense against this disease. You know, when I took a hit in recovery, I got to tell you a little bit of backstory here. At 30 days clean, got my first sponsee. made me call my sponsor and go, what the fuck am I supposed to do? He said, read your book, work your first step. So I worked my first step with my first sponsee. At 60 days clean, I had 2 sponsees. By the time I got a year clean, I had 30 sponsees. Because I believed in this program. See, I didn't play games with this disease. I believed in working steps. I went in meetings. I shared my experience, strength, and hope. I put myself out there for the newcomer, no matter who they were, no matter what color, male or female, I was there. In my area, there are not a lot of strong women that were sponsoring women that could be there, and every girl would come and say, well, I asked a girl to sponsor me, and she said, no, I can't do it. And I had never heard no shit like that. So when they came to me and asked me, I said, yes. And my sponsor said, do you feel overwhelmed? And I said, no. So before long, I worked my way up to about 50 or 60 sponsees. And I did that shit for about 12 years. What happened was somewhere along the way, I got lost. And I said that I got lost because I put so much of myself out there that I stopped taking care of myself. And I went looking for what I had lost, and I couldn't find it. And one night at a meeting, I was sitting in the back of the meeting, and I'm listening to this young kid motherfuck everything that was being said, and I lost it. I went out in the parking lot, and I got in my truck, and I tried to run over about 30 addicts in my truck. Fortunately, they all got out of the way, but the scary part was is that I had resigned myself to going to prison, whether I killed somebody or not. And see, prison is familiar to me. I spent a lot of my life there. And so I went home. You know, my roommate came home later, and I asked him, I said, well, did I hit anybody? He said, no. And I said, okay, cool. And so I got my new sponsor. I went to him right the next day and said, I need help. And I told him what I'd done. And I said, well, I'm ready to work some steps on this shit, find out what the fuck's wrong with me. And he looked at me, and he said, why you want to fuck everything up? And I was like, what? So he wouldn't let me work any steps for quite a while. And he made me go to meetings with him. I sat in the meetings, and he'd ask me after the meeting, did you get anything out of that? And I was like, yeah, blah, 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 I'm fucked up. You know? And so we did that for quite a while, and he gently, very, very gently, held my hand. He guided me back to the fellowship. He guided me back to being of service. He guided me back to helping other addicts, to getting out of myself, and walking this path. Part of my story is that in walking that path for so long, what happened was, see, it was no longer okay for me to be human. Everything I did had to be spiritual. Everything I did had to be right. I couldn't make any mistakes because I had other people's lives that depended on how I lived my life. I held myself accountable because I care. I let myself care very deeply, so I got very deeply hurt. I'm at a place now where for a couple of years I've been working on just being human. It's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to fall short. My sponsor guided me through having to file bankruptcy clean. I was injured in a motorcycle accident in which they told me that I'd never walk again, which is why I'm standing on one leg and trying to baby the other one. I, as a result of that motorcycle accident, was greatly humbled, and people in this fellowship bought Christmas presents for my children. They made it possible that we had holidays and we enjoyed them. They came and picked me up in their cars and took me in my wheelchair and carried me to meetings, and they loved me through all of this. And I got back up on my feet. About 18 months it took me before I could take my first step. And I stood at my roommate's door and I cried and I said, look at me. I'm walking. And it's so hard to stand up here in front of y'all because I'm scared that you're going to die and that you're going to leave me. You see, I need you. I can't survive without you. And I've lost so many people. Both my aunts, one aunt had a heart attack, the other aunt had cancer and died. And then my uncle took a gun and blew his brains out. These are people that didn't even use drugs, you know. And all these hits I've taken lately with these people close to me, it's like, it's just down in here. I push it down, and I get up every day, and I do the next right thing, and I go to work, and I raise my family. I have a new family. I got to tell you guys, I'm getting married in August. And you're all invited if you can find it. We're having a big wedding. I got a big yard, 85 acres. So, you know, another part of my story is for 8 years I stayed away from women. I got burned a couple times early on, and my picker's not so good, so I figured it best to stay completely out of it. And not only that, you know, the sponsor and women part, and it's like walking this path, it's like I denied myself a lot of things in life that I would have wanted to enjoy but really didn't know how. And I couldn't go to none of y'all and ask y'all for relationship experience because you don't know shit. Straight up. all I got to do is watch how the fuck you live, and I can pretty much determine that. And so I stayed out of it, you know, and I pushed all the women away. I kept them as friends. I have some beautiful, beautiful friendships with women. It's something that this fellowship taught me, how to be friends with a woman, how to not have to have sex just because we like each other. And another thing I wanted to talk about, part of the pain that I experience is, you know what, I watch a lot of you guys, and I've held a lot of you guys in my arms while you cried because somebody gave you a disease because you slept with them.
That's right.
Because somebody up in here wasn't telling somebody else they had one. You know what? I got to tell you, that shit rips my guts out when I got to fucking hold you because somebody else has done that shit. So be real fucking careful who you're willing to sleep with. I suggest blood tests, condoms, and every goddamn thing else they come up with. And the best thing I've found, I'm disease-free, is abstinence. So abstinence, by the way, does not mean not masturbating, because see, when I got here, they told me I could do that. Meetings, meditation, masturbation. That is the safest way to recover in this fellowship. And I want y'all to live. I want y'all to know the life that I live today that I enjoy. I learned how to have a bank account here. I haven't written a bounce check in over 14 years. I show up to my job every day that I'm able to crawl out of the bed, usually in more pain than most of y'all experience, because I love to work. It killed me having to lay in bed and watch my children go to work to pay my bills. But you know what? I raised two children in this fellowship, and they came to meetings with me every time I had them. And my children got jobs, worked full-time, went to school, and paid the bills when I got hurt. And I had to look at that shit and go, wow, how in the fuck did I do that? See, because I raised them as a single dad. And right now, I got to tell you, my heart goes out. My little baby's out in active addiction. My youngest daughter is getting ready to turn 18 this November, and she's graduating from high school, and she thinks life is good. And she's selling herself. She's whoring herself out for drugs. I know exactly what's going on, and I can't do a damn thing about it. I lived this thing as an example for 10 years, and I got to witness another miracle. My baby brother came in here and got clean. My brother is still clean today. So I have hope. I have hope that if I keep living this thing, maybe one of y'all that I'm talking to today will meet my daughter and be the one to help her find her way through the door. So I guess all I got left to say is that I'm going to continue on this journey. I know exactly what I got to do because I've been taught by the best. I'm going to look for another sponsor, and it's going to be hard. It ain't going to be easy because I can't get him out of my head right now, and I'm still hurting over losing him. And I want to die clean. You know, I want an eternity chip. I want y'all motherfuckers to have to cry at my funeral. You know what I mean? And I want to love somebody along the way. I want to love somebody that's actually stick around. I'm hoping my fiance will do that. So, pray for me. I need it. I really do. I need it. She needs it. Fuck. I love y'all. All you ever got to do is ask for my help. I'll do everything that I can. But don't ever think that I'm going to enable you. Or that I'm going to fucking do it for you. Because if I see that you can do it for yourself, you better believe that's who's going to do it. That's all I've got. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you for sharing, Martin. I'd now like to introduce our second speaker.
Ernestine.
Hi, everybody. I'm an addict named Ernestine. Speaker statement. The NA member chosen to speak at an NA at a meeting needs to be someone who is working and living the NA program of recovery, which are the 12 steps and 12 traditions. In areas where there is not an abundance of NA members with substantial clean time or experience with the 12 steps and 12 traditions, there is the possibility that a group of inexperienced in Narcotics Anonymous may misunderstand NA traditions and invite speakers from outside the NA fellowship. There are several ways to avoid this situation. Our basic text, for instance, reminds us that NA members from other areas are willing to drive long distances to support new groups. The speakers helps fulfill the group's primary purpose, carrying the message of recovery to the addict who still suffers. When speaking at an NA meeting, we should be careful to deliver a clear message of recovery by identifying ourselves as addicts recovering from the disease of addiction. It is not necessary to dwell excessively on our active addiction or war stories because we all know what it's like to use. We came to Narcotics Anonymous to stop using, and we are here to share our experience, strength, and hope in recovery. God. Before I forget, I need to say thank you to the host committee for asking an addict like me to share experience, strength, and hope at a NA convention. And also, hello to everyone. A special hello and special love to my friends in Narcotics Anonymous, the old ones, and welcome to the new ones. I'm getting older, so I had to write notes so I don't forget. And I don't want to make light of, what's your name? Martin and his experiences and his pain. And I want to say I empathize with you. But as of today, I am happy, joyous, and free. It has been a long time coming. And it's a direct result of being a member, a participating member of Narcotics Anonymous. Through having a sponsor, working the steps, being in service, showing up for my own life, allowing people to help me, even when I don't want them to, that I'm here today. And just for today, if you didn't read it today, it's about being happy, joyous, and free. And what I found out is that, see, I thought happiness came from the man I was with, or the clothes I had on, or the car I drove. And today, reading just for today, confirmed that happiness is a decision that I must make on a daily basis. So that lets you all off the hook. You don't have to make me happy no more. And I have a very, very, very dear friend in my life who has taught me through a suggestion that has nothing to do with a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, but for a way for me to get information that's inside of me, outside of me, on paper when I'm asked to do something. Like, I was trying to apply for this job. If you know about applying for government jobs, you got to fill out these things called KSAs, right? And I know I could do the work, but I couldn't get it on paper to match what the question was asking. So she said, write down everything you do. Once I wrote down everything I do, it was easier to put it in place. So that's kind of like what I did with this topic. And it's one of the things that I'm finding and embracing today is that my God has a sense of humor. And a sense of humor will allow me to go through some painful situations and come out all right on the other side. You know, and God's sense of humor today for me is that me and Martin share a lot of the same feelings. Maybe not the same exact circumstances, but losing people is a painful thing. Whether they die or they still alive. I've had people come into my life, and for whatever reason, I cling to them. And when they decide to leave, I'm devastated. You know, and I've had to learn to accept that people can change their damn mind, understand? You know, I can change my mind. He talked about the sponsorship piece. Up until about a year, this year, I struggled with what you all were going to think about my keep getting new sponsors. I'm on my eighth one. My clean date is March 21, 1991. And recently I've been able to appreciate, even though it's been eight sponsors, they all gave me something. Something special. Something that I'm able to use in my life. You know, and I say this to you, Martin, about the sponsors piece. In our flat book, or It Works How and Why, in the 12th step, on page 119, it says that it may also be the case that we're not the best person to sponsor someone. Individuals have different needs and learn in different ways. Some people may thrive with one sponsor, but not do well with someone who has a different sponsorship style. No type is better or worse than anyone. They're just different. Which gave me hope that my job is just to keep seeking, to just keep developing relationships, because the bottom line is pain, joy, happiness, freedom, whatever emotional state, even spiritual, that I'm in, I got a responsibility. I got to do the work, you know. And I love all the people who have helped me throughout this process. What I have to do is lower my expectations. You know, I was looking for somebody my age, with kids like I got, been through some experiences like I got. And I shared this with a friend of mine in Narcotics Anonymous, and they said, it sounds like you're looking for somebody just like you. I was like, wow, what a concept. Damn. I got to lower my expectations. So I pray that the sponsor will come for all of us. And I went back to, like, when I was born, my mother was 35, my father was 45, so I had a problem. When I got to kindergarten and everybody thought my mother was my grandmother, you know, that was the problem that affected me, because, you know, I thought very highly of what you thought. And then the second problem was that my mom had big breasts, and you saw them before you saw her coming around the corner. I just really didn't like the hand that I was dealt. I didn't know that acceptance was the key. You know, it could have saved me a whole lot of trouble if I knew that, but I didn't. And so I struggled. You know, I was the only child. Loneliness comes with being an only child. I remember, I guess, from 6 to maybe 11, begging my mother every day to have me a brother or sister. I remember my mother telling me every day, stop that crying. You just had somebody spend the night last weekend. Yeah. She just didn't understand the loneliness that I felt. And today, even in recovery, if I'm not accepting of understanding or the gifts that my higher power gives me to just be in today, I could get lonely. And I could tell myself or give my disease permission to carry me somewhere I don't want to be, to take me somewhere that I can't get out by myself. So my friend that tells me, don't go upstairs without adult supervision, is what comes to me when I start to do that. Thank God for people in Narcotics Anonymous. But anyway, what I found through working my fourth and fifth step is that my security was affected as early as childhood. I felt alone. I felt lonely. I mean, I could be in a room, like now, all y'all in here, right? I should feel a part of and okay. I got some friends in here that when I look at their faces and they smile, I feel okay. But if it's not a good day for me, I don't care what y'all say, I'm going to be messed up. And I got a choice at that point whether I want to start my day over again or continue in that rut. You know, what I've found out is that people are here to help me, but it's the ultimate decision is mine. You know, if I choose to be sad, unhappy, got a problem with you, at any time I can change that decision and I can do something different. When I began to use drugs and alcohol, it was to fit in, to be a part of something. And after I did a fourth and fifth step, I realized it was to just make me live. I was really using to live and living to use. And the literature was my identification piece, basic text. When it said, some of us find we have a moral deficiency, I mean, it was like, damn, okay, that's what was happening, you know. And then something about not having to take the whole blame by myself, or having a understanding about why, helps me. I'm kind of addicted to certainty too. I don't want to do something until one of you tell me that you already did it, and then I know I have kind of a guideline as what might happen to me. I hate just walking out there, but I'm getting better at it. So let me get to the most difficult pain since being in recovery was when I had 2 years clean. I had a 15-year-old daughter who was living with my mom, who I had been ducking and dodging while I was using. Who now, y'all, you know, being clean, man, I had to take some responsibility and be a mother. Ew, I didn't want to do that. I was having too much fun recovering, you know. You mean I got to start taking her to meetings with me and all of that? So I was very resistant. But at the same time, she was off the chain. She was smoking weed, drinking alcohol, having sex, wouldn't go to school, very resentful towards me. You know, it's like, I remember the day that I got locked up at my mom's house after a three-day binge of ducking and dodging from the police, because I knew I served undercover. I didn't care. My DJ said, get the rock. Okay. But anyway, I was knocked out, unconscious from being up so long, and this undercover officer taps me on the shoulder. In my bedroom. Where you come from? My mom had let him in. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't get to choose where our help come from. And they said, you know why we're here. Damn, I should have slept over at Beaver House or somewhere, you know. So they locked me up, but on the way down the steps in handcuffs, I glanced over to my right into the dining room where my mother's busily, you know, doing something so she don't have to look. And my daughter's pouring a glass of milk, and she got the smirk on her face. And her attitude was like, now, bitch. You know, today I can laugh about that, but that was very painful. When I come, I went back into before getting clean with that piece, but after I got clean, it's 2 years in recovery, and I got to come back home and deal with her. I was trying to be the disciplinarian, and I told her she had to leave my mom's house. I packed up all that stuff. I put it out front. I went to a meeting. I come back. She and a rack of her girlfriends is in my mom's house, and they in the living room with feet up on the coffee table. They on the telephone. They got the Moet and everything, and they just chilling. My ego, my pride, and you gonna do what I tell you to do, said, what are you doing? You got to go. Long story short, I'm bending over in the closet to get her bags that I packed earlier, and something stabbed me in the back of the leg. She had thrown a knife, just a steak knife. See how trivial I made that? I don't know how to take care of me. She threw the knife, hit me in the leg. I called an addict that I grew up with, who lived around the corner, that came and assisted to go to the hospital with me. It was taken out of my hands by the authorities. I had to press charges on my 15-year-old daughter. Then I had to go through the process of all the phone calls as they called to ask me questions about what had happened, you know, after leaving the hospital. You know, I'm the type of addict. I want everything to happen right now. I wanted them to come pick her up today, you know, lock her up so I don't have to deal for real. Well, it didn't happen that way. It was much later. I was in school, back in college, already scared to death, 35 years old, going back to school. But when I got home from school that night, I had like 15 messages from every institution that they transported my child to, telling me I had an opportunity to come pick her up. God was good, because I didn't need to go pick her up. You know, and I went through the process of going to court with her. The guilt and the shame and the fear of she going to hate me for doing this. It brought about the same fear of realizing that my mom called the police on me. You know, and in that jail process, my mom also was a witness for my ex-husband in his divorce from me. I mean, that she never told me about when I called home every week. You know, I mean, I told you I'm an only child. Who was I going to talk to about that shit? But guess what? My daughter's 30 now. And the sense of humor part is my grandson is 15. my grandson smokes weed. He drinks alcohol. He don't go to school. And my daughter calls me and be like, I can't take it. I don't know how to do this. Somebody gonna have to do this. She told me one day, the school called her. She said, what y'all calling me for? Call the police. And I say, you reap what you sow. I learned just a little bit about how to take care of me. I don't have to take my grandson. It ain't my responsibility. And I'm not going to allow myself or you to make me feel guilty. He knows my cell number. He knows my work number. He knows my house number. If he needs me, he should call me. I'm not going to volunteer and do it for him. I believe that the same God that got me clean and watching over me is watching over him. Another painful situation was after getting here, being here, 7 years, I got married to an addict who I used with. I mean, that was the place I was at when I wasn't at my mom's place. I don't know. I hadn't worked the fourth or fifth step yet. Anyway, I found out through that process, you know, that just like being clean ain't enough for me. I have ambitions and goals, and I wanted to do some other things besides just be clean and go to a meeting once a week or stay on the same job. So I found myself trying to be an encourager and a pusher and a helper, and that shit is tiresome. And he lost several jobs, and we were in competition. I mean, I found out I had excellent credit, so I bought a new car, and then he went out and came home a couple weeks later. Here, honey, here's your keys to the new car. What the fuck you mean, new car? We can't afford a new car. You know, and it was a result of him not doing the step work and wanting some things and believing that Narcotics Anonymous promised you more than just freedom from active addiction. You know, to make a long story short, he began to lie and sell drugs again. The pain in that was, when I tell the real truth, is that how are you going to sell drugs? and I can't. Where you hiding that shit at? And when he gave me the money, the stacks of ones and fives and tens, I wanted it. But I ain't want y'all to know I wanted it. I wanted it, but I ain't feel good about having it. And it brought about the same painful feelings when I first got clean and got my first job and the triggers of having money in my pocket. With rubber bands around it. The feeling of superiority. And so every chance I got, I spent it. I got so much clothes right now that I gotta go home and start throwing away, pulling out some stuff. Because it just was something about having that money that made me feel ashamed. And I knew the relationship was over, but I felt that certainty piece again where, you know, I was waiting for God to say, you can let go. So 3 years later, three arrests later, which was the process. The first time I got the car, he got locked up. I left work. I went home. I sat in a chair. I didn't eat. I didn't sleep. You know, I just was worried and stressed. And the next time it was, all right, see you when you get out. And the last one was, I ain't even show up. I went to work and I went to my meetings. I continued to talk about how I was feeling. I showed up at the court date. I talked to the pretrial people and I told the truth. And he got 30 years. And I made a decision. I didn't take immediate action, but I made a decision. You know, I kept talking to God about it. And what came to me was that God is a loving and a caring God. He does not want me to be miserable. He does not want me to be alone. I am not responsible for someone else's decisions. You know, and today, I still get letters. This is 5 years later. With statements like, I told my cellie my ex. I still get messed up when I say ex. Okay. That's your shit. I can say ex. I got an ex. I got two of them. I still hear stuff like, you know, I don't have nobody. If you can send me some change. I wonder how that motherfucker feel if I send him a quarter. Because the truth of the matter is, I'm the type of addict. When I left my first husband, I left him one fork, one knife, one spoon, one plate, one pot, one set of sheets, one towel, you know what I'm saying? And that was before crack. My mom is 85 now. My dad's been dead. And what I'm discovering is that I have to pray on a daily basis to take away the unwillingness and allow me to practice the ninth step with my mother. Here's a prime example. When I left on Friday to come here, I had work miracles to allow her to have a doctor's appointment that she don't need, that my baby daughter was taking her to. I was confirmed with my daughter that she was taken to this appointment because I got a phone call from my daughter saying they were at the doctor's office. But this morning when I called to say hi and check on my mom, that guilt, first thing she said was, "We got to get this doctor's appointment straightened out." What are you talking about, Mom? I forget immediately to treat her like I would treat one of you all. It just came out. She says, the appointment got canceled. And I know that my family is a small family, just my three daughters and my mom and me, that there's a lot of miscommunication going on. So I'm like, okay, well, maybe she just don't remember. She's suffering from dementia. Maybe she don't remember going. And she told me that they went, but it got canceled. Now, I'm like, two choices. I try to figure out who the fuck canceled the appointment and ruin the rest of my convention, or do I leave it alone until I get home? So I decided to leave it alone until I get home. And the next step, and it works out well with a flat book. In fears and expectations, it says this is a time when it's very important to understand that the way things feel is not necessarily the way things are. Just because we feel afraid doesn't mean there's truly something to fear. On the other hand, feeling excited and happy won't necessarily reflect the reality of making our amends. It's best to let go of all expectations about how our amends will be received. Resolution implies that to find an answer to the problem, we must lay rest what was previously plaguing or disturbing us in some way. Resolution is part of the ninth step. Restoration means to bring back to its former state something that has been damaged. This can be a relationship or a quality that used to exist in a relationship, such as trust. We can perhaps restore our reputations if they were good at some point in the past. Restitution is very similar to restoration, but in relating it to the ninth step, we can think of it as an act of returning something material or more abstract to its rightful owner. So the best I could do for my mom is return my trust in her, my higher power, to work through me for her, and to be a daughter. The best that I can be. To not go to the extreme and try to make up for something that's lost. Try to buy love. Or be anybody other than me. My mother knows that I'm an addict. She's been to 13 of my 15 anniversaries. She says things to me like, "I need you to go to the bank and get me some money. And I need you to make a doctor's appointment. I need you to do this and I need you to do that." And then when I say, "But Ma, I can't do it today because I got to share somewhere or be in service somewhere." And she says, "You need to take care of yourself. You can't be everybody, be everything to everybody and be everywhere." At that point, I got to remember that my recovery is my responsibility. She is not an addict. She will keep me sick. Oh, my God. How much time I have? 15 more minutes? Oh, okay. Y'all going to make me tell all my story. 12 minutes. Okay. The last area that was painful for me but it's getting better is that a year, maybe 16 months ago, I decided to go against what I know and allow this man into my life. I don't know about anybody else, but I've always had a broke picker. And I look at the outside before I get to know the inside. And there was a thing going on the outside that my disease said, oh, no, that ain't going to work. But my friends who love me said, give yourself a chance. So we began to date. And through the process of dating, and I got to know this person, he's a wonderful person. He taught me how to do things I never thought about doing, that I found I enjoy doing. I go fishing. I remember the first time that he took me to show me before fishing season actually started, because that's, I think it's an addiction too. I'm just not ready to work on it yet. took me to places that we were going to visit later on when fishing began, and I shared this with one of my coworkers who been married for 35, 40 years to her high school sweetheart, and she said to me, oh, Ernestine, that man loves you. He took you to his fishing holes. I got to tell you, that really helped my self-esteem. Anyway, at this particular time of my life, my experiences in relationships, and I heard one talking about, you know, they said don't get into a relationship your first year, and I tell you, I heard it, but y'all wasn't talking to me. That was for the other newcomer. So, you know, I experimented, and I got everything I asked for. You know, I can't blame them entirely. I get obsessed and addicted to things that feel good. And I ignore all the signs. All of them. You know, I keep saying, well, maybe that ain't what he meant. I need some clarity. But what those experiences did for me was when I got to the eighth step and I put those people's names on the list, I ain't had no other choice but to practice some forgiveness if I want to be forgave, right? And if I want to continue to recover, because every meeting that I go to is a risk. I'm going to run into you. And I don't want to be in the meeting, not hearing the speaker, because I'm so concerned about what you're going to do or what you're going to say. You know, so I practice forgiveness, and I've gotten through all of that. But anyway, with this new guy, we had a discussion one day. He said, as a result of my sharing my true feelings with him, he said, well, I need to tell you that I don't want to be in a relationship. Fuck you, man, you don't want to be able to, we are. I'm not where you are. He said we could continue to be friends, but of course I didn't hear that part. So in my effort to protect myself, and in my experience of being here before, I'm going to do some big girl shit. I'm going to end it. Ooh, I should have called somebody. That thing was painful. As best I could, I went on. I went to meetings. I spent the weekend with my girlfriend. I binge eating. I read letters. I wrote steps. I called and I told the truth, and I hung up, and then I beat myself up for telling the truth, and then New Year's came. And we both started playing the game. I call Oh, I just call Sal. Okay. He call. I just called to say hi. We had a talk. And what we found out is that we both are scared. This is new. My experience is we tell each other we like each other some kind of way. We had sex. You mind? You move in or I move in. And then we get married. So, or we have sex. You lie, say you're not with nobody. Then I find out you are with somebody. And I hold on with claw marks.
Yes.
And then I work steps 1, 2, and 3. So this experience is all new to me. So to bring you up to date, I'm happy, joyous, and free. We're still together. We don't have no expectations. We talked about it yesterday. When it's convenient, we say we just friends. And the difference is that I'm not holding him hostage and he's not holding me hostage. No, we're free to do our thing. We have enough respect for one another that we are monogamous. And I'm excited about where God has taken me. I believe and I want to be married again. It'll be the third time. But I think I'm marriage material. I know how to be a good wife. And because of my step work, I know how to be. I'm learning and practicing being a good person. You know, so whether it be this person or whoever God shows me, I look forward to that. That's the hope for the person who knows that they don't want to be alone. But it's a difference. You know, you gotta look at it like a companionship rather than a hostage. And you gotta bring something to the table. So the work is to continue working on me so that when I put my stuff on the table and they put their stuff on the table, it won't be no more work to do. We'll just enjoy it. You know. I really appreciate you all asking me to share my spirit, strength, and hope. Enjoy the rest of the convention, and I love you all.